Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Federal health data shows that where you live may determine whether you'll get cancer and what type. On today's program, we explore Michigan's cancer profile. Then we travel to the Headlands International Dark Sky Park. It's near Mackinac City, one of only 10 designated dark sky parks in the whole world. But first, it's not uncommon for voter turnout to be lower on primary day than on the general election day in November. But so much is at stake in Detroit's primary today. Voters will narrow the field in races for mayor and city council, and those will be the leaders working closely with emergency manager Kevin Orr during the city's historic bankruptcy and running the show after Orr leaves. So the need for competent, passionate elected officials is greater than ever. Yet turnout at the polls in Detroit is expected to be in the 15 to 17% range. We wanted to talk about what's behind that chronically low number. And could there be something at play besides disaffected residents? Joining us is Bridge Magazine staff writer Nancy Derringer. Hi, Nancy.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Also, welcome back to Karen Dumas. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Cindy. How are you?
Good. Karen's the former chief of communications for Detroit Mayor Dave Bing, and she's a communications PR strategist. You know, we've spoken with both of you earlier this year looking at the low voter turnout. And Karen, I recall you wrote a piece in Bridge last spring essentially saying Detroiters are paying the price for their lack of diligence. Recap for us what you were saying with that piece.
Well, I think, you know, it's kind of like having a child that you don't take care of, and then you're upset when, you know, someone comes in and takes that child away from you for negligence. So I think in part, you know, Detroiters were maybe a little comfortable or passive in terms of voter engagement, you know, elected official accountability, follow-up, follow-through. And it came to pass in terms of, you know, the appointment of an emergency manager or the situation here economically and even socially, it becomes so compromised that the state felt it necessary to step in.
And Nancy, you found something that could show something beyond voter apathy, and your piece in Bridge Magazine is offering another reason why voters seem scarce at Detroit polls.
That's right, and it's very simple. It's the high cost of auto insurance. The fact is that if you live in the city of Detroit, you will pay anywhere from hundreds to thousands of dollars more for the same insurance you would get on the other side of the city limits for a variety of reasons. But it is literally a economic issue. For a lot of people who, you know, obviously need to have a car in Detroit but do live there. And so what they'll do is they'll take advantage of, you know, a relative who lives outside of the city, you know, and various other dodges to essentially keep their car registered outside of the city. And then if they register to vote in the city, you know, sooner or later your insurer will find out about that and you'll be hit for these, you know, outrageously high premiums.
So in essence, because of this motor voter, people are kind of looking and weighing it and saying, you know what, it's just not worth it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they're, you know, I know people who are in their 40s and 50s with very elderly parents who live outside the city that still use their parents' address for their car insurance and for that very reason. And it's not, you know, it's not a matter of a few dollars. It's a matter of sometimes paying double or even higher than that.
Nancy, can you give us an idea how you came to this conclusion and what kind of digging you did to...
Sure. We had a tip from a source that we use who's a data analyst. And he had actually had a client who was a politician who wondered if it would be worth his while to campaign door-to-door in the various high-rise buildings in the central city. And so what this guy did is he took his own address. He lived in one of those high-rises, and he ran it through what's called the qualified voter file, which is a public document kept by the state which shows the address of every registered voter in the state. And he lives in a high-rise with 116 units. He found 9 registered voters. Mm. One was and he was one of them. And so we repeated that example in several other of the high density addresses in Detroit. And we didn't find anything that was quite that stark, but we did find in buildings like the Park Shelton and, you know, some of the ones down on the river where these new urban pioneers, you know, these young, engaged, educated people who are, you know, allegedly pouring into Detroit, are, you know, they live in these buildings and they're just not registering.
Karen, did this surprise you when you saw this piece of Nancy's?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I remember when I first came back from college and I was transferring my insurance from East Lansing back to Detroit, and there's a street both in Detroit that I lived on at the time, the same name in Grosse Pointe. And so the insurance agent said, oh, and your zip code is 482, you know, whatever, and he gave me all these wonderful. And I said, no, it's 48214. And he says, oh. And the difference in the price quote was just astronomical. So, you know, yeah, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, I pay a tremendous amount of auto insurance. You know, I've had my vehicle stolen from my garage. So, yeah, I mean, I could see that. I mean, it makes perfect sense.
I wonder, is there really any kind of solution to this problem?
Well, I mean, we've been talking about insurance rate reform for the city of Detroit, you know, I dare say for decades now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost a way of life. You expect to, you know, to pay more and almost get less here now. So I'm not really sure where it's going. You know, we've had commissions, we've had commissioners, we've had all these things in place to help resolve that. I know there was a change in how you could report a missing vehicle because there were a lot of cars that were not stolen from the city of Detroit, but they were claimed to have been stolen from the city of Detroit. That didn't seem to, you know, make a difference either.
You know, when I talked to the representatives of the insurance industry, they were pretty unapologetic about it, and they have some depressing data to back up their, you know, their quotes. I mean, they said, I believe, can't remember if it's one third or one half of all the cars stolen in the state of Michigan are stolen in Wayne County. You know, the fact is that if you live in a densely populated city, you're more likely to get into an accident. They're not apologetic about this at all. I mean, they say this is dictated by economic reality.
And I guess what that does, though, is open up the prospect that this low turnout is not simply a function of apathetic residents.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Karen, that gives us something to kind of look at. And also, I wanted to ask you about a piece that actually our friend Nancy Caffer put in the Detroit Free Press, pointing out that the voter turnout might not be as horrendous as it looks because the voter rolls have lots of names that shouldn't be there.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that there has been a lack of accountability on so many levels. So, you know, we're also expecting some challenges in terms of the names that are written or to be written on the ballot and, you know, the whole challenging of the process. So I do think that Detroit is at a point that, you know, there needs to be a reevaluation on so many levels. But the people that are doing the reevaluating and then the changes have to be qualified, committed, and capable of doing so. I mean, if we put people that are back in office or put them in office that are recycled politicians or people that get in on name recognition or out of sympathy, then we're going to end up the same place that we started. I mean, people, when Kevin Orr leaves, whatever this city may look like, for better or worse, it has to be left in capable hands. You know, I do have to say that, you know, I voted this morning and looking at the ballot, I mean, it was a disappointing options on there. I mean, there really weren't, you know, nothing overwhelmingly impressive to me.
Let me just ask, as you went to your precinct, what was the turnout like?
I think I was like number 60. So they said, you know, it was kind of steady. There were people there, but it was not like, you know, the presidential election or anything. There was no line. So, you know, it's yet to be seen. On one hand, you know, the circumstances may energize the voters and say, hey, you know, but then you've got situations like what happened with Prop 4. People say, you know, maybe our voice in the democratic process doesn't work anymore. So it's yet to be seen.
And in fact, that's really where I want to get the thoughts from both of you kind of to wrap up here. And I'll start with you, Nancy Derringer. What do you think is the key? Let's go back to the apathetic folks, the ones who never got around to registering or don't get themselves to the polls on any given election day. What do you think is the key to turning apathy into action?
Ooh, boy, that's a
$64,000 question.
But, you know, I guess I have to fall back on education. You know, you know, I live in a suburb. I live in a pretty affluent area, and I'm just really amazed at how many people simply do not realize that their local elections are going to affect their daily lives far more than, you know, the big presidential election that you're willing to stand in line for. I mean, the people that you elect to things like school boards and city councils and so forth, I mean, these are you know, these are significant. I mean, these are policymaking positions with significant impact on your life. And I think, you know, I mean, maybe we just need a big civics class or something. I don't know. I mean, I think we could certainly make voting easier. But, you know, just to get people, you know, out there and registered and caring and reading about this stuff, you know, they just, I guess they have to know what is at stake.
And Karen?
Well, I think people have to come to the realization that there is a connectivity between their vote and their quality of life. You know, Nancy said, you know, her area is pretty affluent. You know, here there are some economic challenges in the city, and that is the result of either, you know, undereducated or, you know, underemployable constituents here. And so, you know, they tend to have a different perspective, you know, on life and their ability to contribute or, you know, influence the outcome. So I do think the civics class would be great and helpful. I think there needs to be more conversation about how government works. And, you know, people have to, you know, they are always upset about something, but they have to be enraged enough to be engaged.
Well, interesting conversations, as always, as we talk with Bridge Magazine writer Nancy Derringer and Karen Dumas. Always enjoy talking with both of you, and I know we'll be doing it again soon.
Look forward to it. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Still to come. On summer nights, do you ever think about laying out at night, looking up at the stars in complete total darkness? Well, we have the spot for you. That story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, there are 14 names on the ballot for Detroit mayor today, although one of the widely seen frontrunners doesn't have his name appear on the ballot. That, of course, would be former Detroit Medical Center CEO Mike Duggan, who is running a write-in campaign. But in the final weeks of the primary campaign, another man, a barber in Detroit, decided that he, too, would run a write-in campaign for mayor. His name, Mike Dudgeon or Dudgeon, depending on how you pronounce that name. But either way, it's spelled D-U-G-E-O-N. So this is an election where spelling really counts. Joining us now is Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Hey, Rick.
Hello, Cindy.
So as I said, spelling counts. And explain why.
Well, because we have these two Duggins or Dudgeons or Duggins, both spelled differently, as you pointed out. There are also eight others who have filed the paperwork to be write-in candidates. Michigan law says you have to file an affidavit as a write-in candidate if you want any write-in votes for you to count. And, you know, we should also point out that there's another technical aspect of this. You've got to spell the name enough for it to be recognized. And in the case of the two Duggins, recognized as the specific Duggan that you want to vote for, you also have to fill in the bubble, like the old SAT test that we took when we were younger. Michigan uses optical scan equipment, so the machine actually uses that to process the ballot. That tells the optical scan machine that this is a write-in vote and needs to go to the tray in the machine where the write-in ballots go. And if you don't fill in the bubble, then the machine assumes that the voter skipped over that race.
So that's actually two variables, fill in the bubble and then the fact that folks might not know the exact spelling of which Mike they want, Mike Duggan, D-U-G-G-A-N, or Mike the barber, the second Mike, Mike Dudgeon or Duggan, D-U-G-E-O-N.
Right. So what will happen tonight after the polls close is the poll workers will pull out the tray of write-in ballots and they will write down the vote for every distinct spelling of each write-in candidate's name. Every possible iteration of the spelling of those names will each get a separate line in a form that is filled out by the poll workers. So we will see a listing of a number of votes for every single one of those spellings, and then starting tomorrow, it's up to the Wayne County Board of Canvassers to sort it out.
And the Wayne County Board of Canvassers is?
It is a bipartisan board, two Democrats, two Republicans. They are nominated by the political parties. It works on majority rule, but it takes at least one vote from each party to get anything done. So what they will do is they will examine every one of those write-in ballots that's got an alternative spelling and decide which Duggan, the D-U-G-G-A-N or the D-U-G-E-O-N, which Duggan gets which vote. Or if they just can't tell, if it's impossible to make a judgment, then they'll decide that that vote doesn't count at all.
Okay. Okay, so Rick, the top two vote-getters from today's primary go on to the mayoral general election in November. So let's just say that within the top two is one of these write-in candidates, but we might not know for some time if indeed there are enough votes spelled D-U-G-G-A-N. How long could it likely take before we know exactly who's in the top two?
Right. The best case scenario for Mike, D-U-G-G-A-N, is that enough people have gone in and spelled his name, at least his last name, exactly correct, filled in the bubble, that he makes it to the top two. That's the best case scenario for Mike Duggan. The worst case scenario is that there is a plethora of different spellings that need to be gone through, in which case each write-in will very likely be challenged and fought over. The Board of Canvassers has 2 weeks to do its job, but even after then, I mean, it's not an unlikely possibility that this could wind up in court.
You know, if anybody wrote all of this ahead of time and said, guess what we're all going to be talking about on primary day, D-U-G-G-A-N, D-U-G-E-O-N.
We would call that person a very confused personality.
There you go. Rick Pluta is the Lansing Bureau Chief of the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thanks so much, Rick.
Oh, as always, my pleasure.
If you live in the city or the suburbs and you travel to the country, maybe by a lake, what's the first thing that strikes you when the sun goes down? Well, it's probably the incredible show in the night skies. The difference between what city dwellers see every night when they look up in the sky and the same sky when you're on, oh, let's say, the shores of Lake Michigan and Emmett County is unbelievable. And that's the magic behind the Headlands International Dark Sky Park. It's a 600-acre park along the shore of Lake Michigan near Mackinac City, and it's one of only 10 designated dark sky parks in the entire world. Joining us from Emmett County is the program director at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park, Mary Stewart Adams. A pleasure to have you on Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Tell us, what does it take for a place to be designated as a dark sky park?
Well, it takes a lot of community commitment and interest. And in Emmett County, what happened was, because this particular piece of property was owned by the county and it was used as a public park, it required the Emmett County commissioners making a decision to say, yes, we recognize that the night sky is a resource that we would like to protect. And they did unanimously support the initiative to go then to the International Dark Sky Association, which is the longest standing nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting the night sky. And they're located in Tucson, Arizona. Now, this organization has set up the criteria that says, all right, if you'd like to be designated as a dark sky park or place according to our criteria, here's what you have to do to get that designation. And it required creating a lighting ordinance about the property that was more strict than the existing lighting ordinance in the county. It also meant doing a lighting inventory of any existing light on the property, bringing it into compliance, writing a master lighting plan, getting a lot of the community leaders and stakeholders to write letters of support, and then to have ongoing educational programming that's accessible, that's free, and the ability for folks to come any time of day or night and to witness this wonderful wilderness.
So it's a 24/7 park, so you can come at 2 in the morning and enjoy.
Absolutely, especially because sometimes the best night sky things are happening in the wee hours. Mm. So it's really lovely that the county provides this opportunity for the public to come and have access to the shoreline at night. Because oftentimes when you're on public land along the shore, you have to, at dusk, you've got to get off the property, but not at the Headlands. You can come out. So, for instance, when the meteor showers are peaking, it's usually after midnight, and you can be there to watch it.
Long before the Headlands became a designated dark sky park, you had a dream of finding a place to give people a chance to really see the stars. What is behind your love of the stars and wanting to share the stars with others?
You know, I have to say that in me, it dawned as an awareness that we were losing our, you could call it our cultural memories, because we live, most of us, in fact, almost two-thirds of the residents of the United States now live where they cannot see the stars of the Milky Way at night. And I don't know if you're like me. In my early childhood education, I didn't receive any instruction about basic constellation identification or the stories from indigenous peoples connected to those stars, to those constellations. So if you put these two things together, that we're not seeing it, nor are we any longer naming it for our youth, then you can see that we're losing something that's been very important for the cultural history of humanity since the beginning of time. And so with my English literature degree from college and my interest in the night sky, I really, over the years, developed a passion for telling the stories of the stars in a way that would give the common person, the non-astronomer, the person who doesn't own a telescope or a laser pointer, access to the stories of the night sky, because there's a certain amount of, not really fear, but a lack of courage about being able to encounter the night sky and its stories and be all right with doing that as a non-astronomer.
Right. I think we, you're very, very correct, Mary, that we don't get it in school. Most of us can say, well, I can pick out the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper and call it a night.
Yeah.
and so we really are losing an awful lot. But I think you're right. There's an intimidation factor. And you think it's so heavily scientific, I'll never get it anyway. And what am I missing?
Right. Right. And it's also, not to diminish the science, because we have made some fabulous discoveries. But when you look at the history of humanity, you can see that some of the highest achievements in architecture, in art, in literature, and in science, the highest achievements are always out of this same striving to understand what is our relationship as human beings on the earth to this celestial environment in which we find ourselves. And so what I try to do is give voice to the artist or the architect or the humanities type person who's also living and working in that environment. And while you might not have access to a deep sky telescope that's going to show you the 900 million objects that aren't visible to the naked eye, there's still a bridge that was built through this art, through this architecture, through the poetry, the mythology, the literature, even through some of the classical stories that come out of the Bible, all the sacred texts of the many religions. And it's just thrilling to hear those stories under the same sky and find yourself in a dark environment where you can see what was also being seen when those things were created.
If you've just joined us, this is Stateside from Michigan Radio, and we're speaking with the program director at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park in Emmett County, right there on the shores of Lake Michigan, Mary Stewart Adams. And Mary, you say it's a part of your job to speak up for Once Upon a Time. Can you give us an idea of the kinds of stories that you feel are, it's very, very important for us to be able to be in touch with our ancient roots?
Well, I think that because I'm up here in northwest lower Michigan, one of the most important things are the stories that belong to the tribe that's indigenous to this area. And what we have at Headlands is a virtually untouched old-growth forest. So there's a very rich history in this place, the Anishinaabe and the Odawa, who inhabited this area for thousands of years before the first Europeans came. Their stories are very important to us, but then every culture around the world has its star stories. So the Once Upon a Time for me is really about being able to say, look at these well-known fairy tales or these well-known nursery rhymes or these mythologies and these moral lessons that come out of every culture. They're actually rooted in the stars. One that I love to tell, particularly in the month of May, because it's very well known, is the nursery rhyme, Hey Diddle Diddle. Every object that's named in that particular nursery rhyme belongs to a constellation that's visible overhead in the month of May. And most people have the idea that, yeah, that might have something to do with the stars, but it's really quite specific. The cat is Leo the lion. The little dog is Canis Minor. The dish that runs away with the spoon is a direct reference to the Milky Way. So you find this delightful relationship to the stars behind just about everything that has a historical or cultural significance in our history.
You caught us there. We're all going, who knew?
That yeah. Oh, there's plenty more. Mother Goose is filled with it. In fact, it's old Mother Goose, when she wanted to wander, would fly through the air on a very fine gander. Well, that gander is connected to the constellation Cygnus, the swan, which is sometimes referred to as the Northern Cross, that can be seen flying along the Milky Way all throughout the summer months. And it's really beautiful to be out under those stars and reciting those rhymes, those nursery rhymes, those stories. That's the Once Upon a Time time that's really important to me.
And there is that sense. I know I even downloaded an app on my smartphone that supposedly, you know, you can hold it up and it'll tell you what you're looking at. And what it does is remind me of what I don't know about what I'm looking at.
So that's the important thing, is to not be diminished by what you think you don't know, and to say, you know, I can take a step. For a while, I've had a project called Fairy Tale Moons, and what I've done is take traditional folk tales and fairy tales and connected them with the stars. So, for instance, Jack and the Beanstalk. Well, I like to tell that story under the full moon in the month of March, because this is when Orion, the great giant, is visible in both the northern and the southern hemisphere. And this is a pretty pervasive cultural tale about Jack and the giant. And so it gives that sense of, oh, I know that story, and oh, I can see those stars. And there's just a restorative feeling that is really important for us.
Now, we have a meteor shower coming up, correct?
Yes, yes, we do, the Perseids.
Tell us about some of the lore behind the Perseids.
Oh, gladly, I will. So a meteor shower typically takes its name from the constellation in front of which it appears to radiate. And so that's why we have the Perseids. It's named after the constellation Perseus. Now, this particular meteor shower, and actually most meteor showers that we experience, are caused by the fact that the Earth is passing through a trail of stuff that's left by the tail of a comet when it whizzes through our planetary system. So the parent comet for the Perseids has the name Swift Tuttle. Now, that comet wasn't discovered until 1862. The story of the Perseids is coming from as far back as the 5th century B.C.
Mm.
This particular comet has an orbital period of 133 years. So every 133 years, it's coming through and leaving more stuff. But it's really remarkable that it's always staying on the same path, and that we move through that path at the same time every year. And what's happening, at least according to the ancient perspective, and we have to be really careful that we don't try to impose contemporary understanding on what was being witnessed by former cultures. It's pretty pervasive in former cultures that there was a belief that every individual human being comes from an individual star. So now we'll hear physicists say that, well, we're made of star stuff. It's not going quite as far as what the ancients said, which is that you come from a particular star, and it's possible to figure out that star and then read its journey as the kind of incarnation story of your coming to birth.
Hmm.
And when we look at the story behind the Perseid meteor shower, it really has to do with these birth mysteries. So he's born from a shower of golden stars. This is Zeus. Zeus sees the mother of Perseus. She's been confined to a brass-bound vault in the earth because her father, King Acrisius, he went to the oracle to find out when would he have a son. And the oracle says, as oftentimes oracles will, if you're trying to find out your future, it says to him, not only will you not have a son, but your daughter will have a son that will slay you. So he's frightened by this, and he confines his daughter in this brass-bound vault in the earth, and Zeus happens by, and seeing her there, confined, he transforms himself into a shower of golden stars and rains down on her, and that's how she gets pregnant with Perseus. The name Perseus means of Zeus, per Zeus.
Ah.
And so this relationship to the showering stars and Perseus has existed since the beginning of storytelling about this region of the sky. And I think one of the most remarkable things about it historically is that while that story starts to show up around the 5th century B.C., that Perseus is born from a shower of golden stars, it predates the Christian story of the single star over the birth of the Christ child by almost 500 years. So this is a really remarkable coincidence that demonstrates a kind of a developing idea, you could say, without trying to be offensive, but that the stars are intimately connected with birth processes on the earth. And then from the Perseids, at the middle of August, we have the beginning of the meteor shower season. That includes the Orionids that come in October, the Leonids that come in November, and then in December we have both the Geminids and the Ursids. So this last quarter of the year, just as we're getting ready to kind of sweep into fall and head toward winter solstice, we've got this meteor shower event happening month by month, and then when we get to winter solstice, that's when the constellation Perseus is highest up overhead. So it's really a beautiful harmony and symmetry in that.
And what better place to watch it would be the Headlands International Dark Sky Park and have you there explaining that as we're seeing the sky.
Yeah, I like to think so.
Mary Stewart Adams, Program Director at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park. It's in Emmett County. We have put a link to the park for more information for you to find out. It's on our website at michiganradio.org. Mary Stewart Adams, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It was great being here. Thank you.
Still to come, federal health data shows that where you live may determine whether you will get cancer and what type. We'll look into Michigan's cancer profile. That comes up next on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Breaking news this hour, Governor Snyder has concurred with the findings of a review team and declared the Pontiac School District is in a state of financial emergency. The Pontiac District has 7 days to request a hearing to ask the governor to change his mind. If, as expected, the decision stands, the district will be forced to choose between negotiating a deficit elimination plan, asking permission to file for bankruptcy, or a takeover by a state-appointed emergency manager. Michigan's cancer profile. It's cause for unease, especially if you live or work near polluted waterways or land. Federal health data shows that where you live could determine whether you'll get cancer and what type. Journalist Norm Sinclair looks at the cancer hotspots in Michigan for the August issue of D Business Magazine, and he joins us now from Oakland County. Welcome to the program, Norm.
Thank you, Cindy.
Well, you have pored through and you have parsed the data that's available from the National Cancer Institute and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and then you've talked with experts. But let's start with the data. What did you learn about the cancer rates in our state?
Well, it's surprising to see that in addition to the fact that in four or five cancers, Michigan ranks in the top 20 nationally, we have four counties, Tuscola, Wexford, Osceola, and Marquette, that have double the national average for thyroid, childhood cancer, kidney, and brain cancer. And then we have three counties and their adjacent counties, Tuscola, Bay, and Lapeer, on the south side of the Saginaw Bay, the Saginaw River, and they are among the state's leaders in six different cancers. They share three in each county, and then there is a cancer in each of those three that are not common to the others. But they're adjacent to each other, and the amazing thing is Bay County sits next door to Aranac County to the north, and Aranac County doesn't even show up in our statistics.
Huh.
So it's all on the south side of that watershed.
And tell us, Norm, we know that genetics plays such a major role in one's likelihood of getting cancer, for instance, breast cancer. Lifestyle choices such as the direct link between smoking and lung cancer. Do health experts feel that geography is equally as important?
They are cautiously so. And you mentioned breast cancer and lung cancer. We stayed away from those kinds of cancers, colon cancer, anything that could be attributed to lifestyle, smoking, obesity. And we looked at nine cancers, cancer of the kidney, pancreas, thyroid, bladder, leukemia, brain, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and children cancers, which the Institute lists in two different categories, children under 20 and children under 15. We try to isolate those where you could look at geography, environment, and see if there are any dots you could connect.
So how clear-cut are the dots between the incidence of cancer and the environment?
Well, it's amazing. When you look at the data, and they have a wonderful website where you can get on the state of Michigan map by county, and you plug in the information you're looking for, say leukemia, and it brings up the map in color, and the hotspot counties are highlighted in red. And if you put your cursor on a county, it immediately gives you a reading on the incident rate. And when you do that, for all of these cancers, you see a fairly startling pattern up around the Saginaw Bay area, coming down from the Tittabawassee River, the Saginaw River, and into Saginaw Bay. Four counties on the south side of those rivers show up as probably the hottest spots for cancer in the state of Michigan, All on the south side of those rivers. Very little on the north side. So, and again, that follows the flow of the river on the south side out into Lake Huron and then down east coast of Michigan.
And what is the environmental history and the industrial history of that area, Norm?
Well, the number one culprit that everybody points to is the Dow Chemical plant, which from 1890 to 1970 discharged all kinds of waste that later were found out to be carcinogenic into the river. And, you know, the cleanup continues to today. It's one of the largest cleanup, Superfund cleanup sites in the state of Michigan.
And Michigan, despite the slogan of Pure Michigan, there are a number of these EPA Superfund cleanup sites, are there not?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, to go back to that Saginaw Bay, Tittabawassee River area, you're talking about 1,443 square miles. The south portion of the bay, you've got 22 miles of the Saginaw River and a 24-mile stretch of the Tittabawassee River as well. So that watershed up there is about 4,000 acres. You know, they have been cleaning that up probably for the last 10, 15 years.
I'm speaking with journalist Norm Sinclair, who looks at Michigan's cancer hotspots for the August issue of D Business Magazine. And Norm, you spoke of a website where people can actually look at a map of Michigan, look at it by county, and discover which are the hotspots. Whose map exactly is that?
It's called the State Cancer Profiles, and statecancerprofiles.cancer.gov map. And when you bring that up, It has a box on the left side of the page where you put in the cancer that you're looking at, the category. We used people under 65, up to age 65.
Okay. I'm interested in trends, Norm. As you look at these hotspots, what do they have in common?
Lakes, rivers, basically, and a history of environmental abuse through industry.
But with these common trends and as we talked about connecting the dots between past industrial abuse and then current incidents of cancer, it really seems the epidemiologists and the oncologist who spoke with you are pretty cautious, actually hesitant about actually connecting those lines between what industry's done in the past and cancer rates in populations today. Why is it so tough for scientists to make that direct connection?
Absolutely. Well, you know, as Dr. Jadranka Drakovich, she's an oncologist from Henry Ford Health System and a noted expert on environmental cancer, as she explained it to me, the difficulty is you're looking at data today. You're looking at those areas today. You're not looking at them 40 or 50 years ago when some of these abuses took place. So you're looking at a sanitized version of that maybe a stretch of river or a sanitized version of the landscape as it is today, but not how it was then. And, scientists are, as you well know, are very reluctant to connect dots. She thought when she looked at our statistics that, you know, maybe it's time to sort of look at where, you know, there is smoke, there's fire, kind of thing, and and take a closer look at some of these areas.
That scientific reticence, I can only imagine, has to be frustrating if you're raising your family in one of those counties to the south of the Saginaw Bay along that lake here on shoreline like Macomb or St. Clair or Sanilac or Wayne. That has to be very, very frustrating to people who want to feel that there can be action taken and swift action to protect themselves and their families.
Absolutely. Well, you know, if you look at... You look at St. Clair County, where the incident rate for kidney cancer is high, and you look closer there, and they have a very curious and strange cancer cluster in children called Wilms tumor. And it's rare across the country. One child in 500 may come down with it. Yet they have had 8 cases since 2000, and some are in the same school district. And in the case of 2 families, the mothers are friends. And they have been studying that for the last 3 years. The study is about to come to an end, but they're not any closer to pinning down a cause than they were 3 years ago.
That is hard for a layperson to embrace. The other thing I've noted from your story in D Business is this is clearly not a Southeast Michigan issue. It reaches up into the Upper Peninsula, to the Northern Lower Peninsula. So really throughout the state, there seems to be areas of hotspots. But West Michigan, Southwest Michigan in particular, seems to not be in that profile. Am I correct?
Yeah, they have, you know, little pockets, but nothing, not the size of the study that we saw in northern Lower Michigan.
Norm, what is Lansing's position on all of this? We know Washington is putting money in for cleanup through the EPA's Superfund site. What's being done in Lansing?
Well, the DEQ is Department of Environmental Quality, is partnering with the federal government and the EPA and all of this. I mean, they're very, very concerned, and they are partners in every one of the cleanups that are going on across the state. Unfortunately, you know, the state of Michigan hasn't had the kind of resources to put into this kind of study or the detailed studies that you would probably need. For instance, you know, the largest Superfund site in the state and one of the largest in the entire Midwest, where they're budgeting something like $354 million, both the federal government and the Michigan DEQ, is a cleanup around the animal feed fertilizer plant in St. Louis, Gratiot County. And that goes back to our old boogaboo PBB ingestion in cattle and animals back, 40 years ago.
Those of us who grew up in Michigan remember those stories coming out, and it's hard to believe it's been 40 years and the cleanup's still going on.
Absolutely. I mean, this is now a whole new stage of cleanup they're talking about, but to refresh the listeners, we're talking about 33,000 head of cattle were destroyed at that time and buried in state-approved sites in Mayo and Kalkaska County, numerous hundreds of millions, I guess, of chickens and pigs and sheep and rabbits and other things from farms were all buried at that time. And there is still, and again, back to a theme of plants being adjacent to rivers, we've got the Pine River, where this plant stood right on the banks there. And the government agencies are now estimating it's going to cost another $354 million for this round of cleanup. You were talking about the budgetary restraints of the state. The state has been conducting studies on folks and, you know, generations of people from that area right up until a year or so ago when they were tracking 4,000 folks in that area, but they have now farmed it out to Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, where they're going to continue to monitor it, because the state you know, has sort of run out of patience and money to continue that study.
I'm hearing complicated, lengthy, not easily accomplished cleanups. I'm hearing painstaking and slow epidemiological studies. And this really can be one of those stories that makes one feel very, very powerless. Norm, is there anything you think that people who live in these cancer hotspots can do to protect themselves?
I would say be very leery of the drinking water. You would be better served, I think, with bottled water than drinking water, because there's a lot of, in doing the research, you go back over areas that were at one time contaminated, and there was leaching into the groundwater, and the scientific results showed that the water is now safe. Yet you see these cleaned up places are in or adjacent to these pockets of cancer, and contaminated groundwater, contaminated drinking water, I think seems to be a common theme in a lot of these cleanup areas.
Are people doing anything as a community in regions to push for faster action or greater vigilance?
Well, you know, I'm in talking to the folks in, say, Wexford County. I spoke to the head of the community health organization up there, and he was not surprised by the numbers that I threw at him. But he was also of the opinion that that sort of research is being done in Lansing at the universities, and they really have no ability to put their arms around it.
Norm Sinclair's story, Cancer Hotspots, is in the August issue of D Business Magazine, and Norm was kind enough to speak with us from Oakland County. Thank you so much, Norm Sinclair.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
We've been focused on election 2013 lately here on Stateside and the primary and general election in Detroit. But let us turn our gaze quickly to election 2014 and the first congressional district, which covers northern Michigan and the UP. That's where retired sheriff and former military officer Jerry Cannon announced his campaign today. The Democrat wants to unseat second-term GOP Representative Dan Benishek. Cannon is a Vietnam veteran who later joined the Michigan Army National Guard. He was also sheriff in Kalkaska County. The first congressional district was one of the country's most hotly contested campaigns in 2012. So this will be a must-watch race. And a final note this hour, speaking of politics, if you are a fan, particularly of political coverage here on Michigan Radio, then we have an event for you. You can join Political Junkie and our executive producer here on Stateside, Zoe Clark, and her It's Just Politics co-host, Rick Pluta. You heard him earlier on today's show. They'll be holding a special Issues and Ale event tomorrow evening at 6:30 in downtown Holland. It'll be at the New Holland Brewing Company. They'll talk Michigan politics, the Detroit bankruptcy, election 2014, and they want you to join in on the conversation and grab a drink with them. The evening will be hosted by Michigan Radio's investigative journalist at Michigan Watch, Lester Graham. You can find out lots more details on the website, michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is the multitasking and very busy Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by our own Tony Brown. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.